This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your 30 under 30 for another year of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. I'm not your friend. I critique, therefore I am. It's a new album called Happier Than Ever from Billie Eilish. If there are folks who remain frustrated by the use of the term Billie Eilish on this show in the past, I hope that y'all can survive with us for the next 30, 40, 50 minutes as we talk about the new Billie Eilish record and perhaps cast some skepticism on its quality, depending on who will be speaking. Sidebar, lucky for y'all, Karen Gans is not here today. I can fill you in later about how Karen feels about this record. But to talk to me about Billie today, Lindsay Zolaz is here. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Lindsay has a more optimistic take on this album, which we'll get into. Also, Joe Coscarelli is here, Billieologist.
Hey.
It's been an interesting, let's say, 6 or 7 months in the universe of Billie. We had the documentary that came out that was sort of quasi-intimate. We've had what felt to me like maybe the first instances of public social media backlashing against Billie for a couple of arbitrary things. Up until, I would say, the beginning of this year, Billie Eilish was leading a very charmed pop life, and it has started to feel just the tiniest bit soured in the last few months. Now comes Happier Than Ever, and Happier Than Ever seems to, I don't want to say it's a response to that souring, because I'm sure most of these records were done before, but what I am picking up on a lot of these songs is dissatisfaction with celebrity and also dissatisfaction with personal life that is shaping this music in a way that was not the case previously, or at least on previous songs and albums. It felt like the dissatisfaction was kind of existential and internal and gloomy, whereas now there are these other antagonists. Lindsay, you want to talk a little bit about the new enemies of Billie Eilish and how they figure into this album?
I kind of said in my review, as you kind of just hinted, I think the last record, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, was very much like had this aesthetic of like monsters under the bed and nightmares and all these internal demons, if you will. And this record feels a lot more outward facing at both the industry and kind of the culture and particular people who may have done her wrong or done people in her circle wrong. I think it kind of runs the gamut from just bad partners to outright abusers. And she uses that word a couple times on the record, which I found pretty striking. And there's a lot of externalized antagonists as opposed to the sort of intimacy of the first record. And I think in a lot of ways, I was sort of surprised at how much it is a record pretty directly about fame, because the last record, she was on the come up when that record was being made. But this record, I kind of was surprised at how outwardly focused it is and how sharp the claws are for some of these. You know, she talks about having stalkers and having people coming up to her all the time and the kind of fatigue of that. Like I did mention in my review, there almost feels like a Drake quality to it, not so much sonically, but the thematics of just like fame is a drag and it's making me more disconnected.
Right. The curdling, right? Because, I mean, again, so much has happened since the last album. I mean, we didn't talk about the Grammys. Obviously, she swept the Grammys 2 Grammys ago and then won another big award for, I don't know, like a whistling interlude or something last go around. She's clearly in a position where not only has the spotlight turned on her in this kind of like relentless way, but there's a lot of tug of war in the lyrics on this album about moments where she's in control versus moments where she's out of control. And you don't really get that sense on earlier albums. Like, even if she's anxious or stressed emotionally, I always felt like Billie Eilish positionality was a being in control. And the kind of anxiety that comes with being uncertain about if you're in control on this record, I was incredibly struck by. Joe, how did this strike you, the shift in tone on this record?
Yeah, I mean, she's had such an interesting career arc, right, in only a few short years. And I think the fame you guys are talking about, the level of fame that hit her in these last two, came so fast and so hard and with so much scrutiny on, you know, her voice, her body, her relationships, her family. And yeah, you don't often get necessarily someone's I Hate Fame album when they're 19 on their second album. But I went back and looked at the feature I wrote about Billie last time around, which was published in March of 2019, which first of all feels forever ago, was, you know, reported over a few months at the beginning of 2019, maybe even the end of 2018 when I first met her. You know, I'm sort of setting up the stakes for this album and talking about how, you know, she had 1 billion plays on Spotify. She had 15 million followers on Instagram. She was all over the place, but still only speaking directly to her audience, really. I think nobody knew who she was. And listening to this album, I was reminded that, you know, those first 5, 6 Billie singles, which were sort of rolled out over the span of years after Ocean Eyes, her original sort of SoundCloud smash, they were all not big songs. They had, you know, a ton of YouTube views. They had a ton of attention from their direct audience, but nobody had ever heard them, I think, in the sort of wider pop sphere.
Yeah, she didn't have like radio singles in that classic sense.
Even in the lead up to When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? You know, you have the Khalid song, which was sort of a strange little radio hit, but again, not like a world beater. You have When the Party's Over, which is this weird power ballad type thing. And then you get Bury a Friend, you know, which is again, not like basically until you get to Bad Guy, you don't have Billie like the smash artist. You don't have anything that's bigger than sort of the world she built with her fans. And then all of a sudden you have Bad Guy, you have a bazillion Grammys, you know, you have every magazine cover, you have people saying that she's the future of music, which, you know, in many ways she is and was. And that's hard for anyone. And I think it's especially hard for someone like Billie, who came from this really cloistered family and business where, you know, she only collaborates with her brother. They only lived with their parents their whole lives. They all slept in the same bed forever. You know, this is like they're homeschooled. This is like a very sharp turn into like the maw of the world and the internet. And I think we're really hearing like the side effects of that.
What you're saying, Joe, reminded me of when I saw Billie at Radio City. And I just was Googling to check when that was. That is June of 2019. And I remember being incredibly struck at that show. This is not a word I use, but like how underground it seemed for a show that was at Radio City. You had this kind of thing that made sense to every 14 and 15 year old in there. And I could see most of the adults that were there, who were usually parents, just like visibly confused, just really, really not understanding what was happening. It was about as subcultural of a mainstream phenomenon as you could have, because it's not like all the kids were seen kids. Like, they were kind of regular kids. They didn't seem like, you know, they weren't like alt kids or goth kids, or, you know, they seemed like regular kids. They were experiencing something in a way that was intensely personal and intensely possessive in terms of what Billie was doing. And I think that's was a beautiful thing to see, but it's also, from an artistic perspective, I think it's a very safe thing to do as an artist where you have this kind of like full circle symbiosis with a group of fans where you don't have to look outwards and you don't have to feel anything outside of that kind of like cone of safety. But what's clearly happened, and I sort of mentioned this a little bit at the top, is there has been a little bit of curdling or shifting in actual Billie Eilish. And I think that's why this music doesn't sound the way that it did and perhaps is not hitting the way that the old music did.
Yeah, you mentioned that Radio City show, and there was one, I think, like 6 months before that at Irving Plaza, which, you know, was even more so that feeling. And it was almost like you say, like, it's not that the kids were like weirdos necessarily, but it was like almost Odd Future, like in its sort of like bubbling, you know, and you knew that it was about to go over the edge of the pot by design for Billie, less by design with Odd Future, I think. And she would be, I think, really flattered to hear that comparison. But it was just so obvious that that had an expiration date and that all of a sudden this was going to be a household name thing. I don't know that anyone could be ready for that, but I think that Billie especially was not.
Well, I will say actually Odd Future is an interesting parallel. What it actually kind of reminded me of was the first time that I saw The Weeknd play The Garden, I think, or Barclays or one of those big rooms. And it was the first time that that happened. And I remember thinking, everybody here is in on this. And then the next time I saw him in a big room, I was like, wow, only like 30% of the people here were here last time. But the way that The Weeknd changed or compensated or evolved was to make, in essence, increasingly impersonal music, like not music that's about anything. They're just kind of like these shiny, gleaming objects that are kind of like unassailable from outside or even from inside. Whereas Billie is like very clearly still making emotionally tactile music, just about different emotions.
I saw her, I think it was November of 2018 when she headlined Brooklyn Steel, which feels surreal to even like remember
now.
And that was, first of all, I was the oldest non-parent there by about a decade, like was very aware of that. And also like, Joe, I think you articulated really well, like something that I had kind of forgotten about that moment of just how the kind of party line on her. And I feel like it was maybe like, I probably used this line in the piece I wrote at the time, or like it was the headline or something, was just like, you know, she has a billion streams on Spotify. Why have you never heard of her? Kind of the, that was the talking to the other adults in the room. But clearly I also was really struck by the energy of that show and just feeling like this is about to bubble over into something, like she's about to be huge. And another thing I'm remembering about that show too is that she basically had like a panic attack on stage and her dad came out to like comfort her. And I remember kind of writing about that and feeling like, you know, first of all, I think that's was sort of the Billie 1.0 experience in a nutshell of like the family being close at hand. Like Phineas was on stage with her, of course.
And the dad was working the tour. He was like a
exactly.
lighting director.
And he, you know, at first I think when this guy came out and he was like rubbing her shoulders and I was just like, is this her handler? So I don't know what this is. And then she was like, that's my dad. She had to like turn away from the stage for a second. So, and you know, obviously the crowd really responded to that kind of transparency. Like it certainly did not seem like it was like an act or part of the show. And I think that she has always been someone who's been really upfront about her mental health struggles, like from day one. Her music is about that. Her relationship to performing, you know, even from this early moment, has always had that kind of wrapped up in it. So I think, you know, just looking at that being not even 3 years ago now and to where she's come and was already, you know, kind of being transparent about some struggles that she was having, whether it be like performing on a bigger stage or just being a 16-year-old at that time who is on tour with her entire family and that's her life. Like it, there was always that sense of, I think, the anxiety and the emotion being really close to the surface in her whole presentation.
Can I do two sidebars real fast?
Please.
First is, I appreciate how both of you casually flexed on me about going to Billie Eilish concerts
earlier
than the Billie Eilish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who saw her first?
Yeah.
So I watched her perform Ocean Eyes for the first time in her bedroom. No, that's weird.
I just want to know that did not go unnoticed. I just wanted to make that clear. The second thing is, and I actually think it might be worth spending a couple minutes on the documentary, because Lindsay, I remember you and I talking around the time of the documentary. When it comes to family, you mentioned, you know, her dad at that show. And I know that the family stuff really jumped out at you. My memory of our conversation that really jumped out at you at the time watching the documentary, the kind of hoveringness, especially of dad. I didn't feel it quite as intensely as I think you did, if I remember our conversation. But when you were watching that film, what was your take? Like, what was your family takeaway? Because I think my takeaway was something slightly different. So I'd be curious to go back to that for a second.
I definitely want to dig into the documentary because I watched it again recently, which means I've spent 5 hours of my life watching it because it's a 2.5 hour documentary.
It is, seriously.
It has an intermission in the middle.
Can we get a director's cut, but it's shorter? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't want the longer director's cut. I want the actual director's cut that's like 86 minutes.
Several things struck me about the documentary. One is just how she is, you know, obviously this child of the internet, but and child of like digital cameras just being running at all times. Like there are moments in the film where, you know, someone's phone is running video while they're writing Bad Guy. And is that the documentary crew? Like at what point it, like there's really a blurred line of just like what of that was self-documentation of her, both her family and her kind of knowing that this was something that was going to potentially be worth watching in some way later. But I think you really get a sense in that documentary of kind of the like really close quarters that they were living in when this record was made. And it's been said many times that she grew up in a relatively small house with her parents who are working actors, but kind of like went in and out of having work. And her mother also discussed like being impacted by the recession in the film, which I thought was fascinating. And kind of they've been upfront about, you know, not coming from any big amount of money or anything. So you really got a sense that they were always kind of watching out for her and that Billy's career in this way is just like, it's a whole family enterprise, not necessarily in the way of like how we traditionally think about stage parents, I don't think, or that's the way that they want to kind of present it. I think if I was 17 years old, like I would not want my parents nearly as closely like hovering as they seem to be in her life. But at the same time, we're still living through the midst of all the Britney stuff. If only we had a guest on the podcast who could shed some expertise into that right now.
You could draw those lines. You could sew those threads.
But I've had a hard time like not viewing her in that context of at least ostensibly like this does seem to be a family that has known the history of young female pop stars of recent times and is really trying to be proactive in her life to not make maybe the same mistakes that other families had made. And, you know, again, that is the image that's presented to us. I don't know. I think as with so many things with Billy, as I kind of talked about in what I wrote, like it is a little hard to know what is the presentation of vulnerability versus what is the actual vulnerability and privacy. And it gets kind of muddled, I think, by design in her persona. But I do think they're at least trying to present this front of like the family being supportive of her, being aware of her mental health and kind of putting that first in a way that we maybe haven't seen from, you know, the quote unquote stage parents of other teen pop phenoms.
So there's two things in the documentary that to me were maybe the slightly more eyebrow arching things, but they're the iteratively next things beyond what you're describing, Lindsay. One is the Bieber stuff. And we actually texted about this recently, but the Bieber stuff kind of operating as like a specter of what could be and what shouldn't be. And him kind of having emerged beatific on the other side of that. But we all know what the subtext is. And, you know, him trying to like cloister Billy in a sense from that. But the other thing, and this is a much smaller moment in the film, but I thought it was pretty revealing, which is that moment where she's recording the James Bond song and she's like, the internet's going to think this is bad or corny or whatever. And it was maybe the first moment that I've engaged with Billie Eilish stuff where I was like, huh, obviously she's reading, she's paying attention, but she's just as susceptible, even though she's not seeming susceptible, she's just as susceptible as all the people who we perceive as being susceptible. Because that, and that seems to presage this kind of Klieg light anxiety that's on this album. And I think actually we haven't played any other songs, but I do want to play a little bit right now of what I think was the first song that was released that ended up on this record, which is Not My Responsibility, which is essentially like a spoken word interlude. It was, I think it was put out, it felt like it was a first single, but it's not a single at all. Anyway, here's a little bit of Not My Responsibility, and then we'll talk about that.
You have opinions about my opinions. About my music. About my clothes.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm David Marchese.
And I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro.
And we're the hosts of The Interview from The New York Times.
David and I have spent our careers interviewing some of the most interesting and influential people in the world.
Which means we know when to ask tough questions and when to just sit back and listen.
And now we've teamed up to have these conversations every week. We'll try to reveal something about the people shaping our world.
And we'll get some great stories from them, too.
It's The Interview from The New York Times. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so while I was throwing to the song, Joe so graciously corrected me. I think this song was not a single. It did come out in a non-streaming form. There is a YouTube short film that was a tour film, right, Joe?
Yeah, something they were playing on tour.
Yes, but when there was still a tour, this was like in the spring of 2020. The other song I was thinking of that came out before that was My Future, but I do think Not My Responsibility was still a moment where really the claws come out and Billie Eilish is like, stop coming for me. I can't do anything right. Everything I do is wrong. Stop coming for me. And that to me marked a real shift, I think, in terms of the positionality of what she was doing.
Yeah, totally agree. I think a lot was sort of foisted on Billie's shoulders the first time around, you know, regarding her style of dress and, you know, that she was like the anti-Britney and whatever, and that, you know, she didn't want people to be talking about her body. And then she changed and she got older.
Also,
and she
Billie, great style. Sidebar. Great style.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Shout out Itai.
Shout out Bloody Osiris, you know.
Yeah, of course, all day long.
You know, I think she sort of stopped wanting to be boxed in by that. You know, she eventually would dye her hair platinum blonde and do this whole new aesthetic for this album. And, you know, she talks about it on the album a lot in the lyrics, at least a couple times, this idea of these pictures of her, paparazzi pictures, when she's not wearing her sort of baggy girl uniform. And then everybody had an opinion all of a sudden. And this interlude that she was playing on tour, you know, really sort of shut that down pretty quickly and pretty authoritatively, I thought. And I think it works well on the album, but she definitely continued to mine that subject matter elsewhere on other ones of these songs.
If we're going to say that the Not My Responsibility is like some kind of pivot point, where that moment, late 2019 into early 2020, is some kind of pivot point. Lindsay, can you talk a little bit on the album, some of the other stuff that she's singing about that really captures the notion that we're in a new direction?
That interlude ushers in this other song called Overheated, which is a pretty literal depiction of kind of what Joe was describing of these photos leaking and kind of the internet response to it. For a while during the last album era, she was experiencing such success and such kind of like, she just was straight up so busy that it was hard to understand if she was engaging with the internet in the ways that she seemed like she used to when she was kind of first coming up. Like, I do remember, not to harp back once again to being on the Billie Eilish train in 2018, but I
no,
remember
that's okay.
Sort of
flex on us. It's totally fine. It's super fine. I don't feel awkward at all.
That's what I'm here for, to make you feel comfortable. So I remember the moment when her Twitter became essentially run by the management and not in her voice anymore. And that kind of being this turning point, I think, in her achieving a certain level of fame and a certain level of just like a schedule that is not necessarily going to be conducive to her posting her own stuff anymore. Like it, and there was, I remember kind of looking in the mentions and seeing some of her fans like quibbling about that a little bit of like, oh, you can tell this is not Billie because it's all capitalized or something, which she clearly didn't have a very simpatico social media person back then, I guess. Who knows? But it was very easy to see the delineation of like when, you know, she got too big to sort of interact with her fans in that way. Like, I think she uses other platforms. Like we see her on Instagram Live a lot in the doc, but to a limited extent.
And also TikTok. You could tell TikTok when she got on there was sort of like her toying around and trying to find a new safe space, right? Because Instagram had basically been wrecked. So
yeah, I think she and her people around her are constantly like trying to get her to higher ground to not kind of have to deal with the things that she seems to still be internalizing on this record. She is paying very close attention to what people are saying about her. And, you know, I think it kind of is weighing on her in a big way.
Perversely, I almost thought it was like the level of success, not so much bigger than caring about it, but still weirdly before caring about it. You know, like the cocoon, like I think to me it symbolized more that the cocoon was not there, that even though she seemed like she was cocooned, she was not in fact any longer in it. It's almost as if she'd been able to carry that through in the way we were talking about those live shows. We'd been able to carry that cocoon with her far deeper into her popularity than most artists.
I want to go back and just touch on for a second. I want to draw a line between Billie's online anxieties and Billie's like actual real life cocoon and her parents and stuff. Because I think like when you think about Britney and you think about Bieber and the sort of people who got famous around the time that she did and the way we sort of, you know, chew up and spit out our child stars, I think she has been really well insulated from that stuff. And I think I spent some time in that house. I saw her around her parents a lot. It's a very small house, let me say. They live right on top of each other. I think the parents were sleeping in the living room. There's only two bedrooms. Phineas had one, Billie had the other. Eventually Phineas moved out, which I think, you know,
and Billie bought a secret house, as she tells us on this record. She bought a secret house.
What we haven't seen from her is any sort of actual public slip up, right? Like she hasn't gotten in trouble. You know, she has this Dodge Charger she loves. She's not like speeding drunkenly in it. She's not racing it in Miami that we've seen, to go full Bieber. But she always was a 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old on her phone. And she had this entire world, right, on SoundCloud, on Instagram, where she's sort of, you know, in dialogue with all these SoundCloud rappers. She was, you know, friends with XXXTentacion when she was a young teen, you know, mostly on the internet. And you see, you know, Q, her boyfriend, in the documentary, her now ex-boyfriend, we can only assume from hearing this album,
getting waxed on this album
and watching the film.
Shout out Q, like I don't know you, man, but like you got waxed on this record. You gotta move to like Ukraine or like the United Arab Emirates or something. Like you gotta get a fresh start. But
I mean, him and Mr. Bassett from the Olivia Rodrigo album need a support group and a therapist.
Yo, they're definitely gonna be doing like tag team songs.
Yeah, and look, I don't wanna make too light of her, you know, romantic situation. She sings about abuse a lot on this album. She has not come out and said explicitly or named names, but she obviously went through a lot in various potentially romantic situations on this. Not necessarily for us to speculate about. She'll talk about it when she wants to talk about it. She's going to have a long career. But what I was saying is that this sort of online anxiety she always had, the real life anxiety, she's been, you know, she has like bumpers around her. And I think they've been pretty effective. And I think for all the child starness, like I think her parents came into it sort of clear eyed and self-aware about that. But she's growing up and she's obviously testing her freedoms and talking about that lyrically on this album. And she's seemingly run up against some real life obstacles in addition to the sort of Instagram based dread that we all feel at various levels. But I think teenagers feel even more intensely.
I'd like to listen to a little bit of Your Power, which is the song on the record that really most explicitly gets into what seems like potentially a power imbalance, potentially a grooming dynamic, being on the wrong side of a partnership where someone has all the power and you don't. And then let's play a little bit of the song that comes right after that, which is NDA, which feels purposeful that they are aligned one after another, because NDA seems to be about reclaiming some of that authority.
Try not to abuse your power. I know we didn't choose to change. You might not want to lose your power. 30 under 30 for another year. I can barely go outside, I think I hate it here. Maybe I should think about a new career. Somewhere in Kauai where I can disappear. I've been having fun getting older now.
Those songs are interesting to think about as two sides of the same coin, that I think a lot of her music and presentation is about control and power and who has it. And I do think what is different about this record as opposed to the first one is there are these moments where she is not the one in control of her universe. And I think NDA, she definitely is, and there's something kind of playful and kind of slinky about it, as there are in a few other of the songs where she's, you know, talking about like sneaking around with romantic partners and not, you know, keeping secrets from the public about who she's dating, which kind of, you know, goes to what we were talking about before. Like she's kind of dropping these little breadcrumbs and then not giving you much more information. So I think she's often like playing around with this idea of disclosure and how much she owes the public to talk about in specifics. But then the flip side of that is a song like Your Power, where she's really like the line where she says, "How dare you?" is just very, I don't know, like there's a lot of emotion in that song. And I think it was a very surprising, I don't know if I want to call it the first single, because there are quite a few songs that were previously released on this record, but that was sort of the one she released when she announced this album. And I think it was sonically underwhelming for a lot of people, myself included. Like it was not a direction that I kind of thought she was going to go into. And I think the tension of that song kind of gets at the heart of, I think, what is going on in this whole record. Her most defiant songs on this album, where she's taking the most direct swipes at certain people, are sonically the least adventurous, the least abrasive, and the quietest. I think to her, like that really feels like a subversion, and that feels like a way of, again, like subverting expectations of what a Billie Eilish song is supposed to sound like. But I sort of want there to be a little bit more kind of in your face sonics in that moment too, because I think this song just ends up feeling not perhaps as like barbed as it could. It's a very quiet, you know, I don't want to say it's like easy to ignore it per se, but I think it doesn't have the impact of something like the title track. But I find that to be an interesting tension on this record of the times when she's most directly kind of lashing out at people often seem to be on the songs that are so minimalist and so quiet, even for a Billie Eilish song, and so sort of traditional in a lot of ways too. It's like a acoustic guitar ballad, you know?
So there are a number of songs on this record that seem to rely really, really heavily on what we now are all familiar with, which is the very specific husk and texture of Billy's voice. And it does seem like, Lindsay, like you said, some of those songs do line up, the more emotionally scarred ones. And I don't want to say struck by that as songs. Maybe they aren't my favorite, but that does, to me, jibe with kind of like earlier traditionalist, straightforward chanson, Tony Bennett type.
I think we should take this moment. John, let us take this moment for your gloating. You always said that Billy was a torch singer, that she was very traditional in spirit. You've been saying it since probably the first time we talked about her on this podcast. You know, we always made fun of you for it, even though we knew it was sort of right. But she's since come out and said, like, yeah, Frank Sinatra and Peggy Lee, that's me. So, you know, what do you want us to do? Clap? Buy you lunch? Like, what do you want?
That's such like an ungenerous way of telling me how awesome I am. Jeez.
I thought it was pretty generous.
We'll buy you lunch and then we'll clap the entire time while you're eating. Oh my God.
Wow.
I just can't believe we made it this far into the podcast without you bringing it up.
But do you know what I was actually planning on doing? Is I was planning on not mentioning it at all and then going out with a Tony Bennett song. So
Happy birthday, Tony Bennett.
Yeah, it is Tony Bennett Day. I'm glad I stepped on your plan. No, you were totally right. I kid, but also I tip my hat.
I appreciate the support and validation, and I assure you I did not need it. But those songs in particular, like I said, felt very familiar to me because of that pretty clear thread throughout the Billie Eilish catalog. I was actually very struck by, and, you know, I feel like we have some phineasologists on the line today. Phenologists? I don't know what the scientific term is. But I was actually pretty surprised at, let's see. Well, number one, the title track, which one of my notes says this evanescence ass thing.
Ooh.
Oh, but it's a smash though. I mean, that's not
an insult.
Just evanescence head ass.
Real talk. But towards the end of I Didn't Change My Number, there's like that real scratchy kind of it almost just feels like Foley art, you know? It's like some guy, like, on the floor, like, with five sheets of steel being like... And there's, like, two or three other songs that have real moments like that. And, Joe, you and I were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, but those are some unusual choices that, to me, I'm not sure if they totally match up with the songs. They seem cool, but I don't know if they're cool Billie Eilish songs. And it reminds me a little bit of the Taylor Reputation thing, where I'm like, Reputation's a very good album. I just don't know if it's a very good Taylor Swift album. There's moments on this Billie album where I'm like, these are cool and weird songs. And Billie Eilish is a cool and weird performer. I just don't know that these are cool and weird Billie Eilish songs.
It's a funny mix, right? Because I think like it's almost... To do the unexpected sonic thing, you know, throwing back to like the dental drill and Bury a Friend, like that has become like the expected thing out of Billy and Phineas. And like Lindsay said, it's almost more rebellious when she keeps the low keyness. And I think like two places it really works for me, the traditionalism, are on the opening track and the closing track, Getting Older, which is, you know, the one where she drops the sort of killer line that's like, things I once enjoyed just keep me employed now. And like the delivery
on that.
Who
can relate?
I was going to say it. And you beat me to it.
Sorry.
yeah, I mean, that like, and also, again, throwing back to what Lindsay mentioned about Your Power, how she's sort of, you know, throwing these real barbs in like the sweetest packaging, you know, something like Wasn't My Decision to Be Abused, she says in the opening track, which, you know, really, really hit me. And then, yeah, the sort of country tinged acoustic song that closes the album. To me, when you're listening, it's a Billie Eilish album, you expect the sort of break you get in a lot of these songs where then all of a sudden there's some crazy discordant noises. And I like in, at points when they just let her rock over a ukulele or whatever, because she did do that early on in her career also. They've become so known for these little tricks and left field sounds and whatever that it doesn't
always... It's not the emblematic stuff. Like, it doesn't feel like the emblematic stuff. Although I will say that from a musical perspective, one of the things that I was struck by, and this came up, was it on My Future or was it on Lost Cause? I can't remember. Frankly, both of them. I don't always think of Billie Eilish as a singer or performer who prioritizes rhythm, which is to say big picture production, rhythmic oriented songs. But I was surprised on those two songs. And actually, let's listen to a little bit of My Future. But I was really pleasantly surprised to hear how effective her voice and her song construction was in these kind of more rigorously shaped rhythmic contexts.
I know supposedly I'm lonely now. No, I'm supposed to be unhappy without someone. But aren't I someone?
To me, those two songs, I was like, okay, these are pop star songs. They're straightforward, non-specific to Billie Eilish pop star songs. Did they jump out at you in any way, Lindsay? Or is there anything about that kind of turn, whether from Billie or from Phineas, TBQH, that struck you?
I really like Lost Cause. I think that's one of the better singles that kind of got lost in the mix somehow. But I, you know, in trying to envision like someone else singing that song, like, I don't think they deliver it on the same tip, like produce it with the same sort of hush and restraint that Billie sings it with and Phineas produces it with. And it kind of, you know, just a kind of like thought experiment question I was thinking when I was writing the review was like, and I'm curious what you guys think of, like, will there be a Billie Eilish record that is produced by someone other than Phineas? And if so, what does that sound like? Like, I think I emailed Karen at one point and was like, I mean, Trent Reznor's producing the Halsey record, so he should work with Billie next. Like, that makes more sense to me. I mean, I think there's obviously like a bit of a Trent Reznor influence to some of the more abrasive end of Phineas's production. I do love the moment on this record when NDA, I think, goes into Therefore I Am. Like, it almost sounds like it's sampling Closer by Nine Inch Nails. Like, there's a real like industrial kind of churn to it. But that just kind of got me thinking like how their sort of origin stories, like quite literally, are so tied up in each other. And this idea of family is so important to, you know, how we think of how her sound is constructed, how her persona is constructed. Like, do you ever see them kind of branching out on their own?
I think Jack Antonoff is free, isn't he?
No, I'm just kidding. 2024.
No, I'm just, you know, like, whether it's the third Billie album or the 30th Billie album, like, she's going to break away from Phineas at some point, or he's going to break away from her. And
yeah, I mean, he produced Girl, you know, he did some Girl in Red production. It's like he's
definitely branching out.
He's exporting. Yeah. He's exporting the sound.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned Lost Cause as a good single, because I agree. I think, and John talking about her sense of rhythm, I think her delivery, her like snotty delivery is really good on it. And the way she's like interacting with that super catchy bass line, there's a sort of pause and then she says, but you got no job. That's like, this is just really good comedic timing, which I think she's shown throughout her career. But I did feel like there were a few songs on this album that were a little bit too much trying to recreate the magic of Bad Guy and the sort of smashness of it, which was also a plot line in the documentary, right? This idea that she didn't have a hit on the first album and they didn't want to tell her that she had to have a hit because they knew it would put too much pressure on her.
But the thing that's most vexing, and not to get too bogged down in that bit in the documentary, but I thought it was so vexing that there's anyone working in the Billie Eilish.inc who was like, we're going to make her make a hit. It just didn't make any sense because the entire premise of Billie Eilish's success, as we have all attested to with the earliest when we saw her play, you know, on a park bench on Houston and Ludlow, you know, when the entire premise of it is this gravitational pull of an emotional state of being that spoke intensely to young people. It had nothing to do with all this other stuff.
I disagree. And I disagree.
But also it's like, Phineas, why are you a narc? Why are you a narc, Phineas? Like that made me feel a way.
But it worked. Like, it worked. They did it, and she had Bad Guy, and it took her to a completely different level than she would have been if she didn't have Bad Guy. Whether or not that's the best Billie song, I don't know. But I felt like songs like Oxytocin, NDA, those were a little too much trying to be that, you know, Lost Cause to an extent. I feel like they were like, okay, you can make this sort of slow torch singer album if you want, but we need like four Bad Guys in the mix.
Okay, but do you think she's not good at those kinds of songs?
I think she is good at them. I just think this album wants to be the other thing, but those feel like consolation prizes.
Okay, can I ask a separate question about Lost Cause? Okay, I'm just going to ask it. Please. So the Lost Cause video occasioned what to me felt like a real turn in how Billie was perceived. So Billie is someone who is clearly raised on hip hop, friends with a lot of rappers, is proximate to Black culture, Black style. Some people would say appropriating. The Lost Cause video seemed to be a turning point in that I saw a fair amount of critique about queer baiting and also appropriation. And that was something that Billie as a star, a white star working in that space, I think had done a fairly good job over the years of navigating and being on the right side of the politics. And this was the first time where it seemed like the narrative was not in her hands. And I was struck by it because in a way what Billie was doing in that video was not that different from what a lot of other mainstream white pop stars do. It's just that maybe Billie had always done a version of it that felt, I don't know if it was more palatable or more acceptable or less troubled, but it seemed like for the first time she was catching a little bit of heat on that in both of those ways.
What specifically about that video was it that she caught heat for? I missed this.
On the one tip, the queer baiting situation where I just Googled Billie Eilish Lost Cause queer baiting.
Dancing. Yeah,
frolicking with a group of girlfriends, et cetera.
Pillow fight, right.
Yes, like basically female only intimacy in this kind of like toying sexual way that I guess hadn't been consistent with how she publicly presented previously. And in terms of the race stuff, there are questions about the casting of the video, the colorism in the casting, and the way in which sometimes white performers try to, blackfishing may be the strong term, but try to surround themselves with or absorb themselves into a performance of blackness, black identity, and black visuals.
Sort of insulating herself with that, you think?
Well,
I
think that was the criticism. And obviously, I don't actually think she's addressed it or talked about it on either front. I'm not sure. But I think that was the criticism I saw online.
It's interesting because I think some of the most cutting criticisms of Billie and appropriation, I think, were not about her music, but her sort of default use of AAVE in her like social media voice and slang like in speech, which I think is founded, but is also a question for an entire generation of white teen, especially white teen brought up online. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this album doesn't feel in dialogue with hip hop at all to me. Basically. And I think we're almost seeing a turn where white, you know, we'll see what Ariana does next, but where white pop stars are just like, no more 808s. Like, I'm not good enough with the 808s. And like, this isn't my genre. And I think like, whether it's Lorde or Lana or Taylor or, you know, or Olivia Rodrigo, I think,
or
like
Dua Peep.
Or Dua Peep. Like, these are not like these people are no longer trying on trap music for size. I don't think.
I do want to say Dua Peep collaborating with the newly canceled DaBaby. There is a little bit of proximate stuff going on
there.
Yeah, but
even that is like, you know, it feels very stitched on. She's not trying to make seven rings.
No, but also of all the people you just named, the only person who could make seven rings is Ariana.
Sure. Could Ariana make seven rings? Should she have? I don't know.
Wow. Wow. That's a separate episode.
Yeah. I mean, you know, shout out to Taylor Parks and Victoria Monet. Like, they can make seven rings.
Always.
I would say is I agree with you that I don't think this album is in dialogue with hip hop, but I do think, and specifically in the two songs that I mentioned, My Future and to a slightly lesser degree, Lost Cause, it does feel in dialogue with R&B, and not R&B in the Ariana, Melismatic, kind of like Mariah Carey emulatory sense. But My Future especially reminded me a lot of the kind of dance floor oriented R&B that was almost like acid jazz adjacent in the 90s that was coming out of the UK. Music that had clear inheritance from traditional R&B, but took out some of the technical range and kind of gave it more over to dance floor rhythm. I did feel some engagement with that, and that's a different kind of R&B appropriation or engagement than someone like Ariana. And I don't think Billie could do what Ariana does, because I don't think Billie can sing the way Ariana sings.
I think that's right. I think, you know, it's to me, My Future is like a Radiohead R&B, if anything, you know.
I think, too, we're kind of dancing around talking about like the aesthetic of this record, but and how, like, I think you kind of have to talk about aesthetic and fashion a little bit, like in getting into Billie Eilish and how she is someone who seems to literally like dye her hair to announce a new era of her sound. Like, I think there's a lot of connection with, and she really did change not just her hair, but the way she dresses, and particularly in kind of the photo shoots she was doing for this record. It was, you know, she adopted this kind of almost retro leaning blonde bombshell kind of thing, was posed in these corsets in the UK Vogue. And that felt very purposeful of, this is my new era. This era is tied to this album. And I think some people were disappointed that she felt somehow like she was doing something untraditional before, more androgynous, not falling into the trap of more binary gender stereotypes. And that for her to suddenly, I think like you were saying before, Joe, like that I think in her estimation, like the most shocking thing she could do after already being, you know, in some sense, like the walking, shocking parents kind of tarantula coming out of her mouth person, like the most shocking thing I think she could do in that moment was to be like, now I'm Marilyn Monroe, or I'm, you know, whoever. I don't know that that necessarily lands as like a shocking thing, but I do think something that I appreciate it about it is like, it really does feel like a sort of temporary aesthetic that she's kind of saying that this, yes, this is like traditional femininity, and this is one thing I can do, but don't think it's any more authentic than the green roots and baggy clothes that I had on the last record. Like, this is one more kind of costume I'm trying on, in a sense. And of course, like, to getting into the appropriation, that's where it becomes tricky, because I think in a weird way, it was easier to overlook the ways that she maybe did step into hip hop appropriation while it was happening. And then the sudden absence of it, I think, makes it more stark in this moment. I think that the Lost Cause video too is just the really muted Gap ad color palette of even the clothes they're all wearing, like really kind of brings attention to, you know, the issues that we were talking about. But she really seems to have made this kind of like stylistic pivot in both senses of the word too.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did you just tangent about Miley Cyrus, or was that about Billie?
I mean, yeah, no, let's go there, because I think it is. I think the kind of like line on Miley's privilege and ability to dip into and out of hip hop culture, like that is obviously afforded only to white artists. And I think Miley became the avatar of that. I think Billie is doing something less dramatic and stark than that. But I think it is certainly a type of privilege to be able to move as fluidly between these spaces as she seems to have been able to here. And I do think that's kind of catching up with her a little bit in this internet perception that we've been talking about, that is important to talk about with someone like her, because she seems hyper aware of it and in a certain sense has built a career off of knowing how to speak fluent internet and knowing how to avoid those pitfalls up until now.
Well, just as a sidebar, are you saying that Miley bringing out G Herbo at Lollapalooza this past week was theater? Is that what you're saying?
Also, she's back also in her hip hop.
Also, sidebar to the sidebar, if you saw me at Lollapalooza the other day, no, you didn't.
How's your testing, John?
Yeah, I think I'm gonna have a COVID test probably like tomorrow and also 3 days from tomorrow. That's where I'm at.
I'm interested in the question of whether this is working, right? Artistically and commercially. Like when she moves away from whatever the hip hop adjacent stuff, the bad guy, Billie Eilish. My Future, Therefore I Am, Your Power, like these are top 10 songs because it's Billie Eilish and she is the machine at this point, but they're not ubiquitous. Is it hitting it for you artistically and commercially? And does it matter? Or is she just so big that she can do whatever she wants at this point and sort of go back to just speaking directly to her most loyal fans?
This is where I was hoping we'd arrive and where I kind of wanted to end, which is, here we are, we're three engaged, curious people talking about the new Billie Eilish record. What I can't help but think is, are we talking about a record that's just going to kind of go away in a month?
So maybe she is a rapper still.
Oh.
I think this is like kind of the grand paradox of this record, if I can urge. And I think this is kind of what we've been saying all along. She was in this space where she was speaking really directly to youth culture in a way that couldn't even be really perceived by adults in this way. And I think she then became almost too much of an avatar for her generation in terms of like the olds, you know, understanding her. And we're all kind of guilty of that. But I think to me, what crystallizes like the disconnect is the whole Grammy moment, the Grammys sort of adopting Billie Eilish as this next generation savior. Like you said, John, like she sweeps all the awards and then kind of just wins record of the year, I think, by or song of the year last year by default on this like one-off song that she wasn't even expecting to win. So she's kind of been crowned this by people who are not Gen Z, been crowned this like Gen Z spokesperson. And I think in a weird way, her music has now come to appeal more to the people like that outside of the generation that she was once speaking to. And
Granny really voters. Made,
yeah, like she really made a record here that I think is only confrontational to the people that want her to make another bad guy or to go in a more abrasive direction. But I think ironically, like it ends up appealing to maybe the old guard that she seemed not that interested in appealing to it at the time. And I think in some sense too, like her taste is very idiosyncratic anyway. Like she seems to have really been raised on Frank Sinatra and Peggy Lee and hip hop. So like, I think she really does like this kind of crooner style, but I think it kind of ironically puts her back where she was when she was at the Grammys, you know, mouthing to the camera, like, please don't let it be me that wins and feeling sort of uncomfortable being lauded by a generation that she really doesn't really care that much about impressing.
Just to go back and underline how weird that is, everything I wanted winning record of the year in 2021 over Don't Start Now and Savage is just like extremely bizarre and I think very embarrassing for her. Actively, she was embarrassed by it. I think there are ways that she can still be surprising. You know, I think actually my favorite Billie Eilish song, you know, of the last 2+ years is the one from the Euphoria soundtrack with Rosalia, which is like a legitimately weird song. Do you hate that?
It's such a non-entity.
I like how much mist it is. But on the flip side, then the one that's really concrete is like the breakdown in the title track on this album, which like, if we don't go out on that, you know, we can play Tony Bennett too. A, it's an Olivia Rodrigo bridge. You know, I don't know if the Olivia Rodrigo, I mean, her influences are so apparent that it were like snake eating its own tail at this point. Like, I'm not saying that Billie was influenced by Olivia necessarily, but it would not sound out of place on that album. And it's, yeah, it's like, it's Evanescence, but it's also pop punk and power ballad all at the same time. And the lyrics are just really good. And the delivery is really good. And it hits. It's one of the only moments on this album that hit hard, I think.
All right, we can go out on that. Lindsay, Joe, thank you. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get on the Facebook group. Get on the Discord. Actually, can someone post a link to the Discord in the Facebook group? Because I've had a couple people ask me recently, and I keep losing the link to the Discord. So anyway, somebody maybe put a fixed post in the Facebook group. That'd be nice. Subscribe to Popcast. Anywhere you get your audio content. Stitcher, Google Play, Apple, Spotify, and so on. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week.